Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to Motos and Friends. This is the weekly podcast brought to you by the editors at Ultimate Motorcycling Magazine. My name is Arthur Coldwells. This week, editors Don Williams and Nick DeSena discuss the 2025 Triumph Daytona 660. This all-new middleweight triple stands out amongst the well-established parallel twins in the class, and it does it for an exceptional price. In the second segment this week, I chat with the three founders of Moto Psycho Touring Adventures. Pat Campbell, Greg Mason, and Scott Irwick want to share their passion for themed guided tours throughout what they believe is the best place in the United States to ride, New England. All three guys, and their wives, are serious motorcycle enthusiasts with more than 3.5 decades of combined riding experience. They have led safe, organized group rides for over 10 years, and collectively, they average more than 50,000 miles of riding every year. The themed rides sound spectacular, and after hearing their story, I think you will maybe feel the same. I hope you will consider joining them on one of their rides. So, from all of us here at Ultimate Motorcycling, we hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, this is Don Williams, editor of Ultimate Motorcycling, with senior editor Nick DeSena, and he did something pretty cool. He wrote a 2025 already. And Nick, what 2025 did you ride?
Yeah, so we're talking about the 2025 Triumph Daytona 660. Now, we are being a bit tongue-in-cheek with the model year, because obviously we're skipping forward one. But for the United States, or rather the North American market, Triumph North America is calling the bike a 2025. That is actually a text message from the Triumph PR guy reminding me it's a 2025 model. Now, globally, it is a 2024. Okay, whatever. Some manufacturers play fast and loose with the calendar. Triumph isn't alone in this. It's all good. Now, what do you need to know about the Triumph Daytona 660? It is a new middleweight sport bike class, kind of part of the sporty bike class, if you will. It sits somewhere between your standard middleweight naked and a true clip-on laid-in super sport motorcycle. Really, this new class of bike is speaking to riders that want a little more out of their machines. They don't just want hardcore racetrack performance. They want value, and they want something that they can actually ride on the street. So the Triumph Daytona 660 is speaking to that customer that needs to do a little bit of it all. Instead of the hyper-focused super sport segment has really, well, that's what sort of brought on its demise in a couple different ways, but I'm sure we'll touch on that subject as we move along. So that's what we're getting into today.
Okay, so it's not a super sport like a Ninja 636 or a Yamaha R6. It's more like a Yamaha R7?
Interestingly, the R7 is definitely one of the competitors. The class as a whole, if you just want to run down everything, would include stuff like the Kawasaki Ninja 650. That's one of the veterans of the class. And the Honda CBR 650R. Of course, the newcomers and what have really, really kind of reinvigorated this segment in particular are bikes like the Aprilia RS 660 that came out, 3 years ago now? 4 years ago? No, 3 years ago. You also have the Suzuki GSX 8R, or the Gixator, as we call it. And then you also have the Yamaha YZF R7, which is an interesting one. Because that actually has the most traditional super sport riding position of all the bikes that we're talking about today. All of the bikes that I've mentioned have some amalgamation of either a riser clip-on style handlebar that's integrated into the top yoke, or has riser clip-on mounts, attached to the fork in some way. The R7 actually has clip-on handlebars. So despite its positioning being a little bit more street-oriented in terms of its chassis components and just outright performance, its riding position actually is basically what you'd experience on an R6 or an R1. So it's a little more aggressive than the Daytona. But since we're on the subject of riding positions anyway, The Daytona edges towards, I would say, a pretty aggressive riding position overall. It flirts with the idea of a super sport riding position. Yes, we have the top yoke mounted riser clip-on handlebars that are really just, they're cast into the top yoke. So they're not mounted below the top yoke, and I'm just going to stop saying the words top and yoke together because it's a little bit distracting. You know, that said, I stand at 5'10" tall, 32-inch inseam. The bike overall, you know, it has a very approachable 31.9-inch seat height, and that's welcoming for a lot of different riders from a lot of different sizes. So riders much shorter than me can definitely hop on this thing and feel pretty confident about getting their boots on the deck. The rear sets are nudged back and up a little bit compared to the Triumph Trident, which really is what this bike is based off of in terms of its actual hard parts. But the riding position, like I said, flirts with the idea of being a super sport motorcycle. It's aggressive to a point, but never too wristy. So you're never loading your wrists excessively the way you would on an actual super sport, like an R6 or a Daytona 675 or a Daytona 765 RS or something like that.
Okay. We always talk about the handlebar position, but you often don't go into the foot peg position. Is that like the high and tight, or, you know, it's certainly not, looking at the pictures, it's not forward. Where do your feet go?
I would say it's more in line with what you'd experience on many of Triumph's naked bikes, because the past few years, Triumph has just been on an absolute tear with releasing updated versions of their Speed and Street triples. And basically from the waist down, yeah, it is aggressive, but it's not super sport aggressive. So you're not folded into a pretzel. It's not uncomfortable. These are things that street riders are really going to be able to connect with and actually, you know, pound miles with, because when you ride a conventional superbike or super sport, you know, just in an urban setting, it's quite taxing, not just on your wrists, also on your lower half. You have to activate your core to prop yourself up, to reduce the weight on your wrist. Moreover, you have to load your foot pegs and distribute your weight properly. In this case, you can sit on the seat and just relax like a normal person. So while the photos may seem like I'm a bit folded up, depending on what I'm doing, that sort of speaks to the sense that the Daytona has some athleticism in it. You can move around in the saddle. You can have some fun with it, but I'm not uncomfortable when I'm sitting on this thing. The takeaway here is that the Trident chassis has been updated. It's not a carbon copy from the Trident, which came out a number of years ago. At this point, it was a great naked middleweight motorcycle. In my opinion, probably one of the best in the class. And so when we caught wind of a fully fared version, that definitely piqued our interest. There are some changes to really speak to the sportiness of this motorcycle. The geometry is a bit more aggressive in terms of rake and trail figures, but the wheelbase has been lengthened to allow a bit more stability. The takeaway for the Daytona 660 for me is its agility. This is an incredibly agile motorcycle. It wants to steer into corners nice and easy with a level of, we'll say, engagements that maybe other bikes might not possess. And that's despite the fact that it has a fairly substantial 443 pounds claimed wet weight. For comparison, if you're looking at something like the Aprilia RS 660, that bike is much closer to your 400 pound number. Now it's not 400 pounds, but it's not sitting nearly in the middle of the 400 pound range. And interestingly, the Daytona behaves a lot like the Aprilia. Again, the spec sheets would not necessarily convey that information to you. The steel Charles frame, like I mentioned before, it isn't a twin spar aluminum frame for a number of reasons. It's not a full-blown super sport. Okay, it's not the Daytona 675. It's not the Daytona 765. This bike is really thinking about price and how to get people into the saddle, right? And if you start adding those premium quote unquote features, or just simply higher tech features that require higher tech manufacturing processes, things like twin spar aluminum frames, things like fully adjustable suspension, things like IMU supported electronics, suddenly your MSRP starts going up and up and up and up. And that's sort of what's been crushing the super sport category. Is not that those bikes have been getting updated dramatically, which they haven't, but if you look at super bikes overall, the super sport class is becoming more and more expensive. And then you look at the price of an average super bike and you go, well, I think it's not too much more. Why wouldn't I get the one with more horsepowers? So it's an interesting conversation. This bike is not doing the same thing. It uses what we'd probably classify as more affordably conscious components and gets away with a lot in the process. So that brings us to the suspension.
Well, actually, I want to talk about the engine first.
Okay. Fair enough.
Because it's got the 658 triple that's in the Trident 660. Did they change it at all?
Yeah, dramatically. And when we met the Trident's triple, that was an engine that we actually had some experience with, because it dates back to a power plant that Triumph had on the shelf, sleeved down and, you know, modified for its purposes, but it is based off the original 675 power plant. Now, what they've done here is they haven't punched it out and made it larger. So essentially they're creating another 6775. What they did is they teased out a significant increase in horsepower by let's just go ahead and start at the top. It has a larger airbox, has triple throttle bodies as opposed to a single throttle body. Also, the throttle bodies are larger. Bore and stroke, as I said, are the same. But when you start looking at things like the pistons, it has a sturdier crank, low friction wrist pins, redesigned cylinder head that not only has larger exhaust valves, but it also has a higher lift cam. Then also all that stuff is pumped out of a 3-into-1 Undersalong Euro 5 compliant exhaust. You put that together and you've got an engine that is looking a whole lot different from one that's sitting in the Trident Triumph right now. Now, that nets a pretty significant horsepower gain, bumps it up to 95 horsepower and 51 foot-pounds of torque. So really slots into this middleweight class nicely, stacking up against things like the Pirelli RS660, the Yamaha YZR7, and of course the Suzuki GSX-8R, which has a good amount of displacement over pretty much everything in this class, but it makes relatively, you know, similar horsepower numbers.
Now you can talk about the suspension now that my interest in the engine has been satiated.
Well, we haven't even talked about the engine's behavior. That's what we got to get into. As I mentioned, there's a lot of changes. Obviously, they've updated the fuel maps, you know, new ECU tuning, yada, yada, yada. That's netted a higher red line. This is one of those engines that in the class, which is dominated by parallel twin engines, because if you think about the Aprilia, the Suzuki, the Yamaha, those are all P twins. If you think about the Kawasaki Ninja 650, P twin. Okay, the Honda is kind of the only outlier in the sense that it's an inline four. But then you have this thing, a triple. And to me, you know, the argument for the triple is that it has the low end of a twin cylinder engine, but the top end power of a traditional inline four. And this is one of those cases where the marketing lines up with reality, because this displacement, the things that they've done to the engine to update it, it really is that happy middle ground, because you get a bike that has a super broad mid-range. I mean, you can just kind of ride the thing as you see fit, but then it also has a super exciting top end pull. And that's going to speak to a lot of different customers. So you have an engine that below 5K can really help, I would say, intermediate riders that are graduating from those lightweight bikes and coming into this class. They're going to have something that's not going to terrify them, but it's going to constantly keep them engaged and always, you know, allude to the fact that there's more performance beyond what, you know, they're exploring right now. Then you put an actual intermediate rider in it, and they're going to dive right into that mid-range and really make good use of it. Then, of course, you put someone that's a veteran on it, and they've got an engine that they're just going to totally be comfortable ripping around on, sending to the red line and having an absolute blast on, because they can actually control it. You know, it's not like riding a super bike that kind of just goes over everyone's head at this point. You know, and super sports for that matter, although you can't really say the same thing that you would about a super bike. And they're still hardy motorcycles. You gotta have your wits on you. A lot of revs and also that attitude, right? Because with revs comes commitment, and you don't necessarily need that same level of commitment that you would here.
Well, speaking of that, you're talking about the intermediate, the expert. Does this bike have ride modes, and do they matter?
It does have ride modes. It has a very, very simplistic dash. That's one of the other many ways that they're saving a couple bucks and keeping the MSRP below that 10K mark. It's actually the same dash that you and I have experienced on the Triumph Trident. Very similar. So it's a TFT LCD instrument panel. Nothing too exciting. You know, it gets the job done. There's some kind of like, if you're in direct sunlight, it's a little hard to read, but okay, fine, whatever. Three ride modes include sport, road, and rain. You have adjustable traction control levels. And all of the ride modes maintain full power. So Triumph is doing a really good job of, I would say, leading. They're one of the leaders in terms of ride-by-wire throttle tuning. You know, that's been something that a lot of brands have struggled with in the transition from, you know, the mid-aughts, we'll say. And even up until recently, you know, some brands still struggle with that. But Triumph is one that's done very, very well. And, you know, for my part of it, sport mode, that's where I left the bike 85% of the time. And really, if it's a sunny day and you're in some interesting conditions, you have some twisty roads out of you, I don't see the point in taking it out of sport mode. However, if you are an intermediate rider and you want to get your feet wet and kind of take the edge off, road could definitely be something that's worth investigating. Then, of course, you have rain, which really just tames that throttle response right up. So, yeah, you know, the engine for me, that's kind of why you buy the Daytona, because it's a triple, because it's got the torque, it's got the mid-range, and it's got the top ends that a parallel twin can't match. Because typically, parallel twins kind of fall off at the top, but they do really well on low end and mid. Whereas inline fours, conversely, mostly upper mid-range to top end. Like you mentioned before, a lot of reps. The triple, in this case, this triple, it does match the marketing. Best of both worlds.
Well, cool. So, okay, you wanted to get back to the chassis. What do you have to say about the chassis?
So this is one of those things where they are really hammering the point home that, look, this is a middleweight motorcycle. This is going to speak to a lot of people. And, you know, we are trying to revive the middleweight class, and we're not going too crazy in terms of the spec. You know, that's one of the things that Triumph leadership were making quite clear is, you know, this isn't a Daytona 675R. This isn't another super sport, because once you start going down that path of upgrading the suspension, you're essentially creating a more expensive motorcycle, a more focused motorcycle, a motorcycle that isn't necessarily as well suited to street riding and average riders as something like this would be. So you're an average rider, you jump on this bike and you start pushing around, and the show suspension, it's non-adjustable up front. And it also has basic spring preload in the rear. So it actually has the single function big piston fork that's on the Suzuki GSX-8R. I think the Honda has the same show fork too. At any rate, it's a fork that is on a lot of bikes in the market. Triumph has gone for a pretty compliant setup overall. I would say for a more advanced rider, it's going to be a bit underbrung undersprung and underdamped. But we have to remember, this bike isn't necessarily named at an advanced rider. So say you're that graduating into that intermediate category, you're jumping into a middleweight, or you're coming back to motorcycling. What you're going to get is something that's very compliant. It's going to allow you to experience chassis dynamics with, you know, understanding pitch and yaw and things like that. It's not excessively divey and whatnot. That's that. And I think that is going to be the crux of this buyer, is they're going to be getting something that's very, very comfortable. And it's still going to be composed for the most part when you're riding at more reasonable paces. Now, the sort of limitations of the suspension come up when you're, say, a heavier and or faster individual that might expect more holdup out of that fork under hard braking, right? So you're going to want more damping on the compression circuit. And you're also going to want more rebound to keep it from springing up. So it's just lightly sprung and damped overall. The same can be said of the shock. I added a handful of turns of preload. That does stave off, you know, most of the excessive squat, but let's just be real here. The suspension is, again, thinking about the price point, and it's thinking about the intended buyer, which is not necessarily a hardcore track kind of track day junkie type of guy or gal. It's thinking about the more common man or woman that's going to be jumping on this, right? So yeah, we can say what we want about the suspension from a more focused performance-oriented mindset, but we need to think about the core consumer here. Triumph also does think about those performance-oriented people, because Peter Hickman is a name that some of our listeners might be familiar with, of the Isle of Man TT brace. Hickey, as he's known. the guy's won the senior TT a whole lot of times. Anyway, guy rips, as you know, BSB pedigree. He does a whole lot of road racing, and you know, I mean road racing in both senses. So short circuit and road racing like the TT and Northwest 200 and things like that. So Triumph has partnered with Peter Hickman Racing to essentially build out performance parts for the Triumph Daytona 660. And that's going to include clip-on handlebars, rear sets, track body work, and of course, suspension. Now that's going to come to us from Bitubo suspension, but you are going to have an upgrade path to go ahead and do that. So if you want higher grip, you want better hold up, you want more front end confidence, you want yada, 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 because you're a hardcore guy or gal, you have that ability, and they're kind of doing that out of the gate. And I think that's very important because, like I said, the middleweight category is the bridge to a lot of different career paths when we're talking motorcycling. You know, it's not as focused and one-dimensional as a thoroughbred super sport or super bike is. These bikes are going to be ridden on the street primarily, and people will take them racing. They will take them in track days at some point. So, you know, and look, let's be honest, there are things like the SV650 that are kind of, you know, it's a staple converted track bike and race bike. But by and large, SV650s live out their lives on the street. The fact that it's a really good track bike, or kind of used to be, until this class really started taking off and you got the Aprilia and the Yamaha and, you know, now the Suzuki up in the mix, the GS68R, you know, that's what we're talking about here.
No, you got to call it the Gixator. I like that. I hadn't heard that. It's so great.
Gixator.
That's great.
Yeah, that is. It just works.
It just works. That's because it's like GSX8R is almost like a tongue twister, whereas Gixator, I can say that every time with no problem. Daytona 660 is easy to say. I don't have to come up with any sort of like nickname for it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, another cool thing that the Daytona does is it, you know, the big change is it goes to radial mounted calipers. So they are J1 calipers. If you go ahead and get on your hands and knees and start really taking a peek at the calipers, there's some stamping on there, but they're Triumph branded. And those clamp onto 310 millimeter rotors. This is something that I actually do want to bring up because it kind of validates what a lot of reviewers, yourself included, Don, complain about when we ride some of the more affordably priced Japanese bikes. Typically have a axial master cylinder with rubber lines connected to some sort of caliper, whether it's radial mounted or axial mounted, doesn't matter. The thing we always cite is, man, if these bikes only had steel braided lines. Well, I think the Triumph has successfully vindicated the entire Western motorcycle reviewing industry by providing an axial master cylinder, again, saving some money there. Okay, fair play. Steel braided brake lines connected to radial calipers. The feel isn't enormous, right? But it really gets rid of that awful sponginess that we see on a lot of the Japanese bikes. The Suzuki Jixider, for example, has it. It's not good. The Ninja 650, it's known for it as well, although it's not really as hardcore as the rest of the bikes in this category. The Aprilia doesn't at all. Okay, different thing, different price point, also a lot more expensive. This bike is right in the middle. So you get some feel, the brakes work, okay? But they're budget conscious, okay? And they don't have that sponginess, that awful sponginess, that rubber brake lines, just, it's unavoidable. So I know it's a really weird thing to harp on, but look, you can throw in some halfway decent stuff and get good results in the braking department, because for the bike's weight and the bike's performance and what it's meant to do, the brakes work solid. Like, yeah, there we go.
Yeah, the J1, just for the people who aren't familiar with it, you know, you hear that brand, you're like, what? It's a Spanish brand that was bought by Brembo. So kind of like the Bybri calipers, it's just kind of another budget level Brembo caliper.
Yeah, it's Brembo. It's an interesting company in the sense that their ownership and their manufacturing processes are, you know, under some pretty good leadership. And also KTM uses J1 stuff pretty religiously. It's on a lot of the Dukes, for example. And I think some of the 890, is it on the 890 Adventure R? I think it is.
Yeah, but it's definitely a budget pick without it being cheap and crappy.
Yeah, the emphasis on budget, not crappy.
Right. I mean, I've never had any problems with those brakes from J1 or Bybri. You know, they're always, they use them in the bikes that are appropriate for them. You know, you wouldn't put them on the Super Duke 1300 R Evo. So, you know, it makes sense when you have, you know, less intensive braking requirements to not spend the money to have, like, you know, MotoGP level brakes.
Yeah. And really for our listeners too, the thing that's going to really separate good brakes from bad, in my opinion, is master cylinder. If you were to spend a couple hundred bucks and get a Brembo RCS master cylinder and just pop one of those things on this bad boy, you'd get pretty awesome brakes, because everyone goes, oh, I need Brembo calipers, I need Stylemas, I need this, blah, 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 or I need Behringer calipers, you know, I need something. Thousands of dollars in caliper hard parts. No, the hydraulic unit is the one that makes the difference. Now, we're going on a tangent, but okay. What else do you get with the Daytona? You get all-around LED lighting. You get a sporty riding position. We've already hit on that. What else are we missing?
Right. Or wheels, tires.
Ah, tires, yes. Mixed bag on this, because the route we took, you know, you've been to Spain multiple times in your career. I've sort of learned to be very wary of Spanish roundabouts. They're often glazed over with, I don't know what. I've heard it might be diesel fuel because there are a lot of diesel vehicles in that region. It also could just be wear. The tires took a little bit of time. They're the Michelin Power 6. It's what I would classify as Michelin's latest sport touring tire. And, you know, on this bike, for whatever reason, they weren't as confidence aspiring as I would have liked. And I'm not sure if it's down to the road surfaces and, you know, maybe PSI setup, whatever, yada, yada, yada. but it seems like they wanted a little bit more TLC when it came to getting some heat into him. And once he did that, then things started working out. But they weren't a big fan of the Spanish roundabouts. And it's interesting because we've used this tire in other capacities. For example, it's on the KTM Duke 390 or 390 Duke. One of our colleagues just tested this at Jerez, and he did some laps on it at a racetrack, and he was no worse for wear. So I'm going to have to take a mulligan on the Michelin Power 6 on the Triumph Daytona on that particular day on those roads. Okay. I know it's a bit of a cop out.
Well, it doesn't really matter in a way because tires are consumable and you can always, you know, when they wear out, just put on something you prefer.
And also our roads aren't like, you know, some of the Spanish roads out there, which I know for a fact definitely were a bit slick. So is what it is. Sometimes, you know, you go out to a place, it's super beautiful, and then you're like, ooh, that corner is a little, yeah, got to watch out for that one. But yeah, it's interesting because although, you know, once you find your footing on this bike and, you know, it's pretty easy to warm up to, I hesitate to show some of the video we were doing just because we were having some, you know, grand old times and those tires weren't slowing me down. So like I said, mixed opinion on this particular test in this particular environment. So.
Okay. So it sounds to me like we got to prevail on Triumph to give us one of these Daytona 660s with the Hickman upgrades so you can take it out to the track, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's obviously something we got to do for science.
Yeah. I mean, it's like one of those things that you don't want to do it, but you have to do it.
No, I do not want to go to a track day. It's not how I like spending my time, nor do I want to race this thing because it actually classifies within a couple different classes within CVMA and other racing organizations within Southern California. So I have absolutely zero desire to do any of that. And I definitely have not brought that up to Triumph staff.
Okay. Well, we will have to light a fire under their butts.
Yes. But overall, am I happy with the Daytona 660? Yes, because I think the middleweight class is an important class for the motorcycle industry as a whole. That's a pretty grandiose little opinion, but let me get to it. These bikes are trying to come in, you know, sub $10,000. And although, you know, post-COVID pricing is what it is, things are more expensive. You know, obviously 10K, 9K a couple of years ago was going to get you fully adjustable suspension. Ain't anymore, brother. That's just how it is. So, yeah. But anyway.
But 91.95 seems pretty reasonable to me for what you're getting.
Yes, you are getting for $9,195. This is one of the more affordable bikes in the class overall. So we can't let that information slide either. You know, the Aprilia, for example, although it has more features in terms of suspension and whatnot, it also has an IMU, et cetera, comes at a much higher price tag.
Yeah, it's over $12,000.
Yeah, at this point, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you get a lot more. Suzuki GSX-8R, significantly more expensive. Ninja 650, that's the only one that's cheaper. The Honda, on the other hand, that's the one that's kind of offensively expensive. Because that is an old motorcycle.
Right. But it is an inline four. So there's, you know, the increased costs in design, you know, that, and although they're not designing, but in manufacturing that, even though they, you know, they've obviously paid for the tooling long ago on that motor. But that bike, that 654 is both very high priced in both the upright naked version and the super sport style version.
Yeah, when we tested it in 19, it was more expensive than the Daytona, and I don't even know about today's prices. I mean, for the 19, the base price was $9,399. So look, we can squabble about pricing all day, but at the end of the day, Triumph has done a pretty good job with pricing. Now, what do you get with the Daytona? You get a sweet engine. For me, if I'm looking at the middleweight class and I see P-twin, random inline four and a triple, and I go, I think it's going to be the more aggressive Peach wins or the triple for me, because it has that snotty, snarling triple attitude that we see in the larger street triples and, to a lesser extent, the speed triples, you know, because that's a much bigger engine. But the lineage is there, right? So you get an absolutely sweet engine. Shifts well, does everything well. It has a great gearbox. I mean, we forgot to mention the gearbox, but the gearbox is probably one of the best in the class, if not the best. And I hate making statements like that because we're not doing a true comparison. But that's one of those ones that I'm actually so confident in, I'm fine saying that.
Is it got a quick shifter?
No, not standard, but it is an option. We didn't have an opportunity to test it.
They didn't give a quick shifter to you guys? Man, I can't believe that.
I didn't ask, but I assume it was probably an availability thing. Because we've run into issues with that before, not with Triumph, but with other manufacturers where, you know, they might only have a handful of units that they can source, pre-production units, and then there might be only a certain amount of components that they can source for those bikes. Because press trips are, not to get into the science of a press trip, but they're kind of, they have narrow windows to work with, and every manufacturer really, really hustles to figure them out. Triumph is definitely not alone in that, and it's almost every manufacturer is in the same boat. If I had an explanation, that would be it. Because to be honest, historically, you can speak to this too, Triumph quick shifters are pretty damn good. They're typically pretty good. So
it sounds like you had a fun time.
Yeah. No, I'm excited to get this thing stateside, do some track days, put it up against the competition and see where it goes.
All right. So that's it on the 2025 Triumph Daytona 660.
Yep.
Thanks.
Cool.
In the second segment this week, I chat with the three founders of Moto Psycho Touring Adventures. Pat Campbell, Greg Mason, and Scott Erwick want to share their passion for themed guided tours throughout what they believe is the best place in the United States to ride, New England. All three guys, and their wives, are serious motorcycle enthusiasts with more than 3.5 decades of combined riding experience. They have led safe, organized group rides for over 10 years, and collectively, they average more than 50,000 miles of riding every year. The themed rides sound spectacular, and after hearing their story, I think you will maybe feel the same. I hope you will consider joining them on one of their rides. Presumably, you started riding motorcycles together. When was that you first started riding together?
We all met each other as members of our local Harley owners group chapter, Hog chapter. And I'm the newcomer to the chapter and to these guys. I met both of these guys in late 2020 or early 2021 when I joined the chapter and started riding with the chapter. These guys met years before that with the chapter.
I joined in early 2017 and I met Pat right off the bat. He was there before me.
Yeah, I've been a member of this chapter since 2006. But until I met Greg, I'd made plenty of friends, but until I met Greg and Maria, Greg's wife, never really clicked with anybody so strongly. And then when Scott showed up, we had a lot in common and just a good guy, and he ended up clicking with us, and it grew into what we're trying to do with Motorcycle Touring Adventures.
It's quite interesting that, Scott, you joined in 2021, and of course, deep in the middle of COVID. So you're probably sitting at home and thinking, oh my God, I've got to get out and do something here. Mm-hmm. And join the local chapter and obviously hit it off with these guys. Is that kind of how it happened?
Yeah, that's an interesting story, Arthur. I, like most tweenagers and teenagers, I rode dirt bikes and mopeds and scooters and mini bikes and things like that. But I never really did any motorcycling. And in the summer of 2020, my daughter owned a motorcycle, and my wife came to me and said, I want to go take a motorcycle safety class so I can get my license and ride our daughter's motorcycle to work. Do you want to do it with me. And I said, oh, I have no interest in riding a motorcycle. but then I rethought it, and I thought, you know, this is a COVID thing. We don't get to do much because of COVID. So it's something we can do together. It's outdoors, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I'll do it. So we took this class, like, I think in July, maybe of 2020. And a week later, I had my first Harley Davidson. I'm on my third Harley Davidson right now. I didn't crash any of them. I never realized how much I was going to love motorcycling. And in my first one, I told the sales guy, I'm not looking to go away on weekends or overnight trips. I just want to ride around like I do my bicycle. Short rides. And I quickly learned that I needed more motorcycle because I really wanted to do the longer, the weekends away and things like that. So that's how I got into it. That's how I ended up joining the chapter. And the chapter does rides that are anywhere from an hour long to a week long. The three of us, in particular, really love riding together.
It's an interesting lead-in that ladies, i.e. your daughter and your wife, got you interested, which is, you know, back in the day, that was obviously sort of typically the other way around. And interestingly, we've found, last year, we now something like 20% of our audience is female. Which is great and it's really interesting. I love that. I love the fact that ladies are getting involved. I mean, my wife rides and so on so that's very encouraging to hear. I really, really like to hear that. But then obviously having got yourselves sort of started riding and as a group of part of the Hog chapter, you then decided to really start specializing in your local area and actually develop a touring company?
Yes, I'll tell that story too. The three of us were on a touring rally with National Hog. We were riding from Maryland back up to New Hampshire. It was a 4-day rally, I think it was. And Pat and I were rooming together. And we're in the room one night and he said, hey, I want to talk to you about this idea I've got going. And so he told me about his idea for a motorcycle touring company that that takes people on rides around New England, the roads that we know very well, the beautiful scenes that we know very well. And he said, I've already talked to Greg about this and he's looking to be a partner with me. And I wanted to find out if you were interested. And so I called my wife and she said, yes, I'll drive the sag wagon. She does ride, by the way. But she would love to be a part of it. She said she would love to be a part of it. And all three of our wives are very active in the business.
So Pat had talked to me a few years ago about doing this. And I think what made it sort of happen was he retired from the local shipyard, Naval Shipyard, at the end of May last year. And I sort of did the same in the middle of September. So that freed us up a lot. And Scott's got a flexible situation with his work. So we can work on getting this thing going and going riding and what have you.
Yeah, it was interesting. So this was an idea that I'd been percolating for years and probably been sitting on it for 9 to 12 months, and Greg and Maria, myself and Cassandra, who you've spoken with, my wife, went on a trip at the height of COVID, but some of the hotels were open. So the four of us took off in September when it was just starting to get cold, which may not have been the best idea, but it was still a good trip. And at some point on this trip, I had already spoken about it to Greg, but I'd come up with a logo idea and all these different things. And I pitched it to Greg and then the idea kind of went quiet, but it was still there and I still wanted to do it. And flash forward to 21, late in the summer, did one of Greg's rides with Hog And afterwards, they left it up to me to go and get everybody home, make sure guys got gas or people got gas. And we got home and I'm running the GPS on the bike to get us home. I'm running the GPS on my phone to get us to a gas station. And I turn a corner and the sun hit us in just the way. It was like an epiphany. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. And we just started from there. And then a year later, hanging out with Scott, we talked about it. His interest was piqued during that Roland rally. A month later, we did another trip together. And I just jokingly said to him at one of the stops, because he had picked out the hotel and it was just a perfect setup. I'm like, all right, when we do this, you're in charge of hotels. He's like, we need to talk about that. A month later, we started getting serious. So October of 22 is when we started getting together and getting serious about this. And we formulated in February of last year.
That's awesome. Okay. So that's clearly the genesis behind the idea. But I suppose really going to sort of the 30,000 foot level, it's you guys are from, you know, a beautiful part of the country. It's not necessarily the typical place I think that riders would think of traveling to. I mean, I'm based in California. So obviously California has a lot of great roads and, you know, there's a lot of riding there, you know, and obviously we all know about, you know, the Dakotas and sort of Sturgis and all the roads around there. But if somebody said to me, you know, oh, there's some great places to ride, I got to be honest with you, Maryland and New England wouldn't necessarily be my first thought.
Right.
And so that's quite an interesting difference that you guys have struck on there.
Well, and our way of looking at this is we know we have beautiful roads. We know we have great scenery from the coast to the mountains, which you can do all in one day. And the way we've approached it is to make our tours themed tours. For example, our first tour this year is in May. It's all covered bridges. We've got it set up where you either drive through, drive by, or stop at over 30 covered bridges in 4 days.
Wow. Okay, that's really cool. I've only seen like two of those. And I've ridden all over the country. That's awesome.
Right. And as another example, our second tour, which is in June, and we've planned each tour each month, May through October, which is our typical best riding season. We ride all year round, but those are the good months. And the one in June is lighthouses. So in 5 days from Massachusetts to the easternmost point in Maine, which is also the easternmost point in the continental U.S., you see almost 30 lighthouses.
Wow. Wow, that's really cool. Okay, so to get more into the sort of the nitty-gritty of exactly what you're doing, how many people would you typically expect to be on a ride? Or how many motorcycles, I would say, actually?
So our limit that we're starting with, and this is our first full year of making this happen, our limit is 10 motorcycles. Now that can be two up, that can be solo riders, but 10 motorcycles plus the three of us as your road captains.
Right. Okay. Do people need any particular skill set in order to ride with you guys, or are you able to sort of educate people on all of that?
Well, so if you guys don't mind me continuing, we have an interesting, actually a very good relationship with the owners and our local Harley dealership. And we've been setting up day tours as well as single overnight tours for new riders. And we're still working through a lot of that with them. But the expectation on that end is to be able to take new riders that have just graduated from their riding academy, have gotten a new bike, we can take them out, give them the experience of group riding without the pressure of being with experienced group riders other than us. So we've got that, but when it comes to our tours, we make sure when things are explained on the website or as we talk about different things on the socials or start interacting with these participants, that they know this isn't a beginner tour. We are going to places that you may have to stop in a gravel lot to look at a lighthouse. That's Maine for you. Different things like that. But we make sure that's all known in advance to give them an educated decision, or to allow them to make an educated decision on whether the tour is for them or not.
But we're looking for people who, you know, they got to have license, insurance, a bike, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we're hope you know, we don't anticipate getting anybody who hasn't done it, hasn't ridden a fair amount, I guess.
What about people that are traveling to visit you? Are there sort of rental bikes available and that sort of thing?
We are aware of a place to rent motorcycles about 20 miles or so from where we begin most of our tours. It's an Eagle Rider. We don't have a relationship with them. We could send them to Eagle Rider and say, you know, check and see if there's a motorcycle available. We would not make those arrangements for them. One other thing that we will do for out-of-towners is if they want to trailer their bike in, we have permission from our dealership for them to park their trailers in a locked, fenced, locked parking lot at the dealership, which is very close to where we will start all of our tours. So we've got those arrangements made for them if they choose to trailer in.
Are you hoping to sort of attract maybe some international riders, you know, people from Europe who, you know, obviously I'm from England way back when, and, you know, to sort of escape the rain and the gray and the cold would be pretty nice to come out. And I'm sure there's a lot of English people that would love to come out and experience the East Coast.
We'd love to have them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. When you start a tour, I mean, clearly it seems as though, judging from what Pat said, it's across several days. So do you base yourselves in one hotel and then do separate rides on, you know, each day, or do you go from hotel to hotel to hotel?
Usually it's hotel to hotel to hotel. We are planning a destination ride that's to Pennsylvania, down to Gettysburg and Amish country. And it's, and again, you talk about rider experience and stuff. It's, we're advertising it as, you know, like a long highway day to get down there. We are staying at the one hotel for three nights, and then we can see the sights, take rides, et cetera, et cetera. And then a 2-day trip back.
What sort of mileage are you planning on covering each day? Are these going to be long, hard days, or are they pretty relaxed?
It's kind of a mixture thereof. Like Greg talked about, this New England to Pennsylvania tour we have in August. That first day is a hard, let's make it happen, get down to Amish country. We're staying outside of Lancaster in Pennsylvania. And that's a longer day. I think that one's close to, or a little over 500 miles. If I remember correctly. But then coming home, we're doing that in 2 days. So we break it up a little bit between highway and back roads. But our other tours, I would say the average is from probably 180 to 250 miles in a day. A lot of them have stops. Another one of our tours is in September, which is a perfect time for it. Leaf peeping season up here, they call it. I'm not from New England, so that was new to me. They even have it on the weather forecast, leaf peeping season. But we're doing country stores. So over 4 days, we'll visit 15 different country stores out in the woods, out in the middle of nowhere, all over New Hampshire, Vermont, Mass. And those are even shorter days. Those are probably between 150 and 200 miles per day. Although we do have one day that's a little bit longer, so we can hit some nice twisties.
So clearly this isn't just sort of, you know, highway droning. This is going to be some, it sounds like some really nice twisty roads and some pretty stunning scenery.
Yes, with the exception of the destination tour to Pennsylvania, we will rarely be on a highway. It's almost always going to be two lanes, twisty, very scenic roads.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, my wife and I, we drove our RV around the country, and we took our motorcycles in the back with us. So we were able to ride you know, the Blue Ridge Parkway and the Tale of the Dragon and all those, which are obviously a little bit further south from you. But I have to say, you know, Maryland and New England was absolutely stunning. It was just beautiful.
Well, and it's funny because a lot of the people that we ride with, as we approach middle of September, beginning of October, they're putting their bikes away. It's the end of the season for them. And you get into those colorful fall days, they might be shorter, but they're still awesome riding. And it's beautiful. And we have so many roads that are tree covered. It's like you're riding through a tunnel, and it's just stunning.
If somebody wants to do like a self-guided tour, are they able to do that? Or are all your tours guided?
All of our tours are guided. We have not thought about offering out them as unguided tours. But what we have put together is we are able to custom design tours as well. We have the ability to take somebody's budget. If they only want 3 bikes, or if they want as many as the 10 bikes, we can find their hotels. We can find their roads. They want to look at specific things. We'll get them there, and we can set that up based on their budget.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I like that. I like that a lot. Do you have a chase truck, you know, following you guys to carry, you know, luggage and all that kind of crap, or does everybody have to be self-contained?
We are self-contained. We're doing everything self-contained right now. That is a thought for the future. While we don't have a chase vehicle or a sag wagon, as you hear in other things, we do have the ability to get help to us and get somebody if they've got to be pulled off the side of the road. Although part of what we require is that they have coverages to help them in those situations.
Well, I guess to get onto the nitty gritty, what's the sort of the pricing of this kind of stuff?
So right now, 4 of our 6 tours that we have planned out are ready to be booked. They're available to be booked. The New England to Pennsylvania tour should be available in the next day or two by the end of the weekend. And then we haven't mentioned our 7 state tour, which is in July. Basically, you're going to get to see every state in New England plus New York. We do that in 4 days.
Wow.
And it's a little faster paced, but it's still not crazy. And you get to see a lot of beautiful sights. And then the 6th one is in October. And if you thought about it, if you knew New England, you'd probably guess what it is. Haunted New England. And we're still developing that to make sure we get you to some spooky sights. Our New England Covered Bridge tour, we have it set up for both single occupancy at $1,395 per person and double occupancy at $1,115 per person, $1,115. Our New England, that's a 4-day, 4-night tour. And then moving on to our New England Lighthouse tour, which is in June, towards the beginning of June. It's 5 nights, 5 days. Single occupancy is $1,980 per person. And double occupancy is $1,495 per person. And 7 states tour again in July, $1,745 and $1,375. Our New England to Pennsylvania tour, as you can imagine, destination tour, probably a little for us ends up being our most expensive, but still not crazy. It's 5 nights, 5 days, right in the height of August. $2,095 per person, single occupancy, $1,615 double occupancy, and that's per person. And then our New England Country Store tour is late September, grand leaf peeping period, especially as far north as we go. $1,685 per person, single occupancy, and $1,330 per person, double occupancy. And again, our Haunted New England tour, we're still developing.
What does that include? I mean, presumably that's hotel rooms. Does it include things like meals and snacks? I assume it doesn't include gas.
Right. It does not include gas. It includes all lodging. It includes breakfast most days, because typically we're staying in hotels that have free breakfast. And it includes, so the night before each one of these tours, we have a kickoff dinner and a safety briefing, tour briefing type of thing. and that dinner is included. And then at some point in the tour, usually the last night that we're on the road, but in at least one case, it's an earlier night in the week, we have a celebration type of dinner, celebrating each other's new friendships and just the fun that we're having on the ride. And that is, that dinner is included as well. And then it's the, you know, the tour development and the professional guiding that we're offering to the tour.
Terrific. What are the sort of quality of hotels that, that you get for this? Are you staying, I assume you're not staying at the Ritz-Carlton, but I also likewise assume you're not staying at Motel 6.
Well, it's definitely a mix of hotels, motels. We've tried to check out a lot of them that we're going to stay at. We don't want it to be yucky, but you know, it's not like the Ritz Carlton, like you said. But we kind of like the motels. I think that's a good feel for bikers. They, you know, roll right in, park in front of their door, load their stuff in. And you know, some hotels that are not motels, obviously, just, you know, you go up the elevator and you go in. But, you know, we're checking them out, so there's nothing yucky.
We do have a tour that it's not planned for this year, but it's on our schedule to plan, which would be New England Grand Hotels. So,
oh, lovely.
This would be an inexpensive tour. It would be staying at hotels like the Mount Washington Resort or the Balsams Grand Resort, you know, just those old New England, really grand hotels with ballrooms and all of that. We're kind of excited about being able to offer that one.
Are there any of maybe on the longer tours where you perhaps have a rest day or something like that?
The only one that would right now or could is the New England to Pennsylvania, that destination tour, because we're going to be 3 days in the same location. And we're planning tours around the area, Gettysburg, Battlefield, Amish country, but someone could elect to take the day off and stay by the pool all day or whatever. So most of them, all the rest of them, there are no rest days planned in the middle of the tour.
We do have an exciting feature that we're working on for our Haunted New England tour, where it's a half day of riding. We're going to stay near a train station so that people can take the train into Salem, Mass for the last Saturday of October, which should be bonkers, but is a blast.
That sounds really cool.
We'd like to mention our website and our socials. Our website is moto, M-O-T-O, dash psycho, C-Y-C-O, .com. And then you can find us on Facebook or Instagram at Moto Psycho Touring. And on YouTube at Moto-Psycho Touring Adventures.
And there are links to our socials right on our website.
That is true too.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely terrific. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate you coming on and telling me about it. I wish you a lot of luck. I'm sure you'll be actually very successful. It sounds like some great routes you've got. And I really like the idea of the themed tours. That sounds really cool.
Well, thank you very much. We really love riding, but we enjoy putting this stuff together too. And we have before we ever started the business.
Yeah, I'll bet.
We appreciate the opportunity to have a chat with you.
Yeah.
Thank awesome. You. Well, thank you very much. It was good talking with you.
Good talking to you too. Take care.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.